Another episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. You'll notice that I'm speaking a little bit quickly today. I'm speaking a little bit quicker than Jody McIntyre, who's a person with cerebral palsy, who was pulled out of his wheelchair by police during a protest in London following the cuts of student funding. And not only was he pulled out of his wheelchair, dragged across the road, but it happened twice! And the BBC reporter talking to him said, "Oh, but this particular website says in one particular sentence that you're a revolutionary. So were you, considering you're a cerebral palsy sufferer in a wheelchair, acting menacingly towards these tall, enormous police that are armed to their teeth?" Oh, the tyranny. And it seems that if you are a protester, you are the new soap scum. That's right. I need to wipe you out. Oh, ruthless. And it's terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible. You can't get it through your mind just what kind of a sociopathic scumbag psycho police officer, and I'm not bagging all police officers here, in general I love them, except when they're arresting me. or, you know, imposing draconian measures and never questioning authority and never caring about the people whom they submit to. This is one of the hallmarks, I think, of a society gone wrong. Now, one would ask, what would be the logical reason to assault a man in a wheelchair during a protest? I have a question. That's the question. Here's the answer. Just like problem, reaction, solution dictates, you need to create a problem, and then when people react, you propose the solution. Here's the problem. The protests weren't quite violent enough so that the police could crack down on everybody. So, in an effort to make the protesters really angry, they drag a person who is severely disabled, unable to even push himself along with his own wheelchair, being pushed by his brother, out of it, drag him across the road in order to incite violence from protesters so that they could crack down even further on them. Now, that's my opinion, and I could be wrong. And I certainly hope I am. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. We'll be right back after the break. Days are getting darker. They seem to be getting colder too, especially if you're in the northern hemisphere, where the Gulf Stream, the source of warmth for most of the Northern Hemisphere is now shut down thanks to the Gulf of Oil Cano crisis. Thanks, BP. You're a bunch of crackerjack scumbags, aren't you? And in punishment for them shutting down the Gulf Stream, oil prices are going up and so are the oil companies' profits. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and also, hi everybody down in New Zealand listening on 89 Rush FM in Hamilton. That's right, we have secured our very first New Zealand affiliate station, and we are very happy with that, and we are now taking this show global because there's a heck of a lot of real dumb New Zealanders who certainly need to be exposed to the show and the topics that we discuss, because unlike mainstream media, we're actually a heck of a lot more serious when it comes to actual issues, even though we laugh about them and make fun of them. Conveniently enough, though, we have somebody a little bit more seriously than myself coming on with us today. His name is Bob Nichols. He's a writer for Veterans Today, and indeed he's a Project Censored Award winner, a correspondent for the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, and a frequent contributor to various online publications. He reports on war, politics, and the two nuclear weapons labs in the Bay Area. Nichols is writing a book based on 20 years of nuclear war in Central Asia, and he is a former employee of an army ammunition plant. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vincent. It's great to be on.
Hey, you sound absolutely happy. Have you got some good news for us?
Oh, no.
I'm just joking. I know you've got no good news. Now, I've just got your article here today, straight out of Veterans Today. GI's brains fried by military-dispensed nose candy.
What oh, yes. The heck that is article going on here, totally. Bob? That article totally went viral, dude. I mean, it just zipped around the world again and again and again and again. I suspect it's because the happy happenstance of the title.
Mm-mm-mm. After you know, all, people are very interested in nose candy these days.
Roger that. You can bet on that. But
especially the CIA.
Oh, yeah. They have these really neat predator drones, the big ones. Are the ones that they use to carry dope back and forth between Afghanistan and California. The really big ones fly at 65,000 feet, you see. And this is kind of serious stuff, but 65,000 feet is what you call above controlled airspace. So they don't have to check in with anybody. They take off in Afghanistan with 3,000 pounds of dope. They fly and fly and fly till they get to either some army base, an Air Force base that they stop off at and get refueled. But pretty soon they're in California. These things can stay aloft for 48 hours.
Wow. I wonder how badly irradiated all those drugs get with that higher atmosphere exposure. Now, speaking of being irradiated, USGI's brains. It's now official that researchers have shown that uranium oxide, or DU, depleted uranium, for those of you who are not in the know, which is far from depleted in terms of its toxicity, travels the nerves from the nose to the brain, in the words of a University of Chicago doc and researcher, and even so much as a milligram of this radioactive poison marches up your smelling nerves right into your brain and keeps firing. It's the ultimate weapon, 1.2 million bullets a day, forever. And that's a bunch, about 850 rounds per minute. Could you please explain and elaborate, what is DU?
Oh, it's a weapon that the United States Expeditionary Forces had decided to use about 65 years ago. It was what they were – you were actually going to use it for – any. Do you have listeners in Japan?
We've probably got one.
Okay, that was that one dear soul in Japan. 65 years ago, when the Americans went over and bombed Japan with atomic weapons – They had a backup plan. Now, you can't make this stuff up. It's just unbelievable. But they had a backup plan. And as the Manhattan Project guys told General Groves, the guy who said that he was the honcho of it, well, if the nukes don't go off, they called them gadgets. If the gadgets don't go off, we'll use depleted uranium. He said, "What was that?" And it was the stuff they'd already processed to make the bombs out of. So he said, "Well, okay, sure, fine, that's okay, that works out good." And what they were going to do was simply spread it all over the land, and the people too, of course. And it would kill the people, it would kill the land, it'd be that way for ever, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's nice that they like to share.
To this day, I mean, we're talking about 2010, soon to be 2011. Zoom fast forward from 1945. That is a trip from 1945 to 2010. To this day, the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab brings in samples from Japan, and they test them. Because it's still an experiment. Has it stopped? Still being.
Radioactivity seems to be popping up freaking everywhere, right? We had Lorraine Murray, radiation expert, on the show yesterday telling us that there is now radiation in our water supplies, even here in New Zealand. And I went out to a company breakfast this morning in my dad's old factory. And I tell people about this, and, you know, you should have seen the blank stares that they get, and they're like, oh, well, you know, I'm getting irradiated when I drink water and have a shower. Isn't that perfectly okay? And what really concerns me is the fact that troops themselves, particularly when DU is being used in weaponry, when the rounds pierce, say, tanks or armor or anything like that, the DU particles basically explode into atomized dust that you can't stop with most air filters, and it gets into their bloodstream, and it makes Gulf War Syndrome seem like a picnic, really. And the ongoing effects of this, and particularly contamination of the land, soil, those kind of things, environmentalists this day and age are too wrapped up in climate change to notice that there is a heck of a lot of radiation in areas where US forces have been using this type of ammunition. Now, what are the particular effects and symptoms that are appearing in troops today, Bob? What kind of symptoms of DU radiation exposure are people seeing?
Well, when you get this DU, imagine that you're just an old boy walking around in Iraq or Afghanistan, and you're just trying to do your job, you know, not get killed by either the bad guys or the good guys. You can get shot by anybody. But you're kind of walking around, and then you feel you think, well, is that a slightly metallic taste in my mouth, and you just walked through absolutely invisible haze of uranium oxide particles, so small you can't see them. They're also called DU, but I don't like to use that word. It has the word depleted in it, and that's totally not the case.
It's totally disingenuous to call it depleted.
Let's just call it what it is. It's a lie.
Yeah. And, well, let's just call it uranium
oxide. If you walk through this uranium dust, you're on top of it, Vince. You walk through this uranium dust, and the particles are so small that, you know, when you're at your computer and you right click on a word and it comes up with the definition, or the window comes up and it gives you some choices. Well, with these particles, size is now what's called a property. Size is a property. Because when these things are fired, they don't have to hit something. It helps if they do for their change. But from the moment they leave the muzzle, these rounds are on fire. And it's the smoke that gets you. Now, I'm sure that, although hopefully you have a reduced rate now, not too many people smoke in New Zealand, but for those who do, you've seen a cigarette with smoke coming up out of it, and the smoke just kind of disappears in the air. And sometimes you can smell it, but you can't see it. But you walk into a room where people have been smoking, and you go, oh, gosh, somebody's been smoking in here. Well, if you walk into a room or a field, or if you dive into a ditch and you dive through or you walk through this uranium haze and you can't see it, you might have this faint metallic taste in your mouth. You don't think anything about it. It just doesn't pass your mind that it's anything. But you've just been hit. You've just been got. You've just been shot. You got the American battlefield product of uranium oxide, either through your skin, through your clothes. You might have breathed it. You might have eaten it. It goes through your skin. It goes anywhere. And wherever it lands is where you start to hurt. Now, these things are so small. They're so small that they're less than what's called a billionth of a meter. In fact, you can divide that by 10 to make it 10
less like than a millionth of a micron.
There you go. There you go.
It's a millionth of a millionth of a millimeter.
Small. In fact, we can't even really figure out quite what to call it. It's you want to use something less than small.
You want to use a really big word that describes something that's so small, you know?
And they thought of that word. They thought of that word. And, of course, it's a word to confuse people because it's complicated. But the word is nanometer.
Nanometer.
A sub-nanometer particle means a particle that is less than a billionth of a meter.
Hmm. Now, the effect of this, I understand, is actually contaminating many, many, many troops, particularly troops that are in Iraq, where much of this DU weapons, much of these uranium weapons have been used. So what's happening? I mean, are these people being treated for these kind of thing? I mean, what do you do once you're contaminated with uranium?
The governments involved do not admit it. The governments involved deny it. The governments involved tell the troops when they come back that it's all in your head. You're crazy. You got PTSD. You're nuts. No, there's nothing wrong with you. Now, that pain that you feel all over, it's nothing. Here, let's give you some medicine from our friendly giant pharmaceutical company. We'll make it.
Let's give you some lithium for energy, you know. There's people
there's people listening to the show right now who have this, or they have somebody in their family that has this. And, of course, for them, it's a tragedy because there's no treatment, Vinny. There's no cure. There's
no treatment, no cure that... Are the troops even warned before they go into battlefields where uranium weapons have been used that they could be contaminated?
My friend Doug Rocky, who's retired now, is Army, and he was in charge of the depleted uranium project. 30 year vet. And he prepared the material. It was approved by the general who is now the head of the VA. A Hawaiian named General Shinseki. And it has never been distributed. It is, in fact, the actual law and rule. The law says that is the responsibility of the VA to take care of these people, to acknowledge this, and to give everybody medical treatment, period.
This is the Veterans Association.
the Veterans VA of America, a giant bazillion-dollar organization. They absolutely have nothing. They deny it. The one doc who was chasing after it, named Dr. Durakovich, and nuclear medicine specialist, sitting, they fired him. The other docs in the VA, very quickly, these smart guys, it doesn't take long for them to get the message. You understand what I'm saying? So they backed off real quick.
Well, that's the terrible thing that I find about these sorts of issues is that not only do the troops, the people who give their lives what they think to be in service of their country, but they get put at risk and then get denied any form of treatment after the fact. You know, it's total tyranny. The worst kind is when you turn on your own people. Right. And I think that veterans worldwide are being targeted right now. And indeed, in the United States, people who are veterans are, in fact, being put on watch lists and things like that to make sure that they don't have weapons. And it's preparing for domestic insurrection. And this is something that I've deeply concerned about, even here in New Zealand, is that these troops have no idea what their government is doing for them, nor do they have any idea what is indeed planned for them. If you are, say, an oath keeper, for example, somebody who actually swears an oath to the Constitution and means it, you will be a target of the government. They don't want you to believe in people's inalienable rights. They don't want you to be healthy. They don't want you to be able to think for yourself. And they certainly don't want you to get any health care from the poisons that they make you exposed to. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Exactly. You're listening right. to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. With Bill, my very favorite guest is Bob Nichols. We'll be right back to the...
Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin.
And welcome,
no telling who that it's naming.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, powered by pure uranium.
Oh, God. That's awful.
Hey, it's the lighter side of genocide, all right?
Yeah, I can dig it. Yeah, gosh. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Now, we aren't going to offend any veterans out there, but understandably, if you are currently infected or contaminated with uranium dust, we don't mean to offend you. We don't mean to make you feel belittled or anything. At the very least, we hope to talk about these issues in a way that is informative, but also hopefully not take it so seriously, because in times like these, if you're too serious, you will go friggin' nuts. You need to keep your sense of humor about it. So no offense is intended. I respect veterans and all those people who are lied to by their governments. Now, Bob, you were telling me earlier this morning, we had a brief chat about anti-recruitment When recruiters in America come in to speak to schools, they'll basically lie through the nose to, you know, say, oh, you're going to get girls, you're going to get plenty of money, you're going to get educated, you're going to see the world, you're going to go meet ancient, interesting cultures and kill them. And you've been indeed touring schools and giving them advice to the contrary. Give us a bit of a breakdown, mate.
Well, we talked about the size as being a property of these weapons. And when you tell the dudes, the men and the women, these are kids, they're teenagers, American teenagers. And when we're talking about size as being a property, when the bullet or the shell or the bomb leaves the muzzle or the aircraft and explodes or hits, it's on fire. It's on fire from the second it leaves the muzzle. And it's the smoke that kills you. The smoke. You know, you can't really see smoke. A cigarette is a good example, although these pieces are smaller. They have never existed in the history of this world before. They only started existing in 1941. They're less than a tenth of a billionth of a meter. And I can't even think about how small that is, but it's real small. And the thing that people who have been in the Army or vets, and the things that the kids all can identify with, if they understand it, they've seen it, they see it on television, is that these little milligrams, little bitty pieces.
Nanometers, you mean?
Nanometers. Yeah, we got a fancy word. We got a $10 word for this tiny, tiny particle. First, how many of you people, out New Zealanders and people around the world, have made a pot in a kiln? Yeah, a clay something in a kiln. Where you put it into the kiln, it's 2,500 degrees or so, and it cooks for a while, and it becomes impervious to liquids. Now, of course, most people think liquids as being water, but then, of course, in our case, it gets real serious real quick because it's blood that we're talking about. So this is inside of your body, real small. It's been fired by being shot from the muzzle. Only it burns at 9,000 degrees.
And it melts through armor like a hot knife through butter.
Yeah. Now hold it right there. That's it's really important that you said that. Because we talked about focus group tested words before.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is 2010. In 1991, the Iraqis had a few old Soviet T-22 tanks. They were shot up within 5 hours. They don't have any more. Afghanistan doesn't have any tanks. Dude, you understand what I'm saying? The tanks is a word and an image, a visual that the Pentagon put in your brain. They put that in your mind. They said, it's a tank. It's anti-armor. And Vincent, you were probably like, you know, what, 6 or 7 years old. And you hear this Pentagon thing, guy talking on the television, he said about tanks. And yeah, tanks. Well, no, it's on fire when it leaves the muzzle and it hits some building or hits a car. Hits a bunker, but there are no tanks in Iraq. The only tanks in Iraq are ours. They are 140,000 pound vehicles. They're 12 feet wide. They're more than 20 feet long. And they weigh 140,000 pounds or 70 tons, short tons, so that they don't tip over when they fire. They fire really, really fast. this 10-pound rod out of pure uranium. Yeah, it's 97% uranium. Few additives in there. It doesn't make any difference. So this pure 10-pound rod of uranium gets fired. It's on fire. It's the smoke that gets you. Whenever it hits something, building or water tower, water treatment plant, bunker, whatever, some concrete thing, one of Saddam's palaces. Well, what would it hit in Afghanistan? I guess they got a few buildings there, huh?
Well, the intention, the intention behind using
pictures of tanks that say Afghanistan on them.
No,
they don't belong to America.
Wait, hold on. I remember one. There was a clip in a movie called Fahrenheit 9/11, made by Michael Moore, depicting a whole bunch of Taliban clambered onto this one tank, hauling ass the F out of there.
A armored personnel carrier or a tank? I don't remember.
Oh, it was definitely a tank. Yeah. Well, but that's the only one I've ever seen, right? and I had a serious doubt that tank is alive today.
They were shot up within minutes.
Yeah.
So there goes the Pentagon's rationale for these weapons. Besides that, a missile is a much better thing to use against a tank anyway.
Because you can fire it
faster. They're faster. They have more wallop, and they're more accurate. And you can shoot them from standing further off anyway if you're shooting at enemy. In fact, uranium weapons aren't even good weapons. There are weapons in the pipeline that have been held back for decades that shoot better, further, faster. Better, further, faster. Can we think of anything else? They're better. They're better.
Yeah.
But the uranium weapons have one thing that the others don't. And that is they kill your kids that aren't born yet.
Because
they get right in there and they destroy what's scientifically called the germ cells of humans. Regular human, everyday walk around humans, you know, people, we know those as sperm for men and eggs for women. And these things are attracted to those kinds of cells because of what they're made up of. And these uranium ions go on in there, and here's the magic part that everybody can identify with. You've either fired or seen a machine gun. This is serious stuff for people who don't like war. But everybody who's been in a war, who has seen a machine gun, who knows anything about them, know they fire, they rather naturally fire about 15 rounds a second. That translates into 900 rounds a minute. The range is usually given at 800 to 900 rounds a minute. And they fire that way kind of naturally. Well, isn't it amazing that this little milligram, this thing that if you can see a piece of paper, it's the period at the end of a sentence. That's a milligram. Size of a milligram of uranium. It fires 850 rounds a minute forever. It never stops. It never jams. It never needs reloading. It never runs out of ammunition. And it's shooting little bullets. And you say, well, Bob, how far do the little bullets go? I mean, they're just little bullets, aren't they? Well, yeah, they're little bullets. But in the scale of a cell in your body, of course, we've all seen pictures of cells and drawings. We can't see them. But it has a range of about 20 cells. Now, that's 20 cells up, down, and around. So if you take 850 rounds a minute, forever, and that little thing is wedged in your elbow. Do you think your elbow's going to hurt? Vincent?
Will? Yeah, well...
Speak up.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. The stated intention of these weapons, uranium weapons, is to be anti-tank, right? Because of their amazing ability to burn through armor. But the real intention, and this is what I love about politics these days, is whatever they say, basically to think about something that's the direct opposite or whatever, and you're probably more likely to the truth. The real objective here is to basically contaminate the land and contaminate all the people within it so that you don't have to fight them for generations. You know, they're just absolutely ruthless.
Exactly, and that's biblical. It's in the Bible. And Attila the Hun did it. And armies have done it for years. What they used to do thousands of years ago, and in the Bible, in the Quran. You go to some city, you camp outside of it, you put a siege on the city, and then you slaughter every man, woman, child, and most of the dogs. You kill everything. That's how you prevent the next army from being bred. Now we're talking about breeding. If you take a couple hundred thousand humans, they are going to have children. It kind of happens that way. But if you take a couple hundred thousand humans and you put sprinkle uranium dust all over them for 20 years. No, they're not going to have many, if any, normal, not worked out kids.
And this is evidenced in Iraq at the moment. Birth defects affect approximately one quarter of all new births. And this is an extreme phenomenon which popped up just after the first Gulf War, where uranium was in fact used. And the dust particulates are so small and carried by the wind that they've basically contaminated more or less the entire country. So much, in fact, that now when a baby is born in Iraq, the general question that, say, if a baby was born in the United States, that the parents would ask first is it a boy or a girl? And in Iraq, the most commonly asked question is it normal? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. My very special guest is Bob Nichols from Veterans Today, and we'll be right back after the break. Uranium. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another radioactive episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, slightly outside of the Iraqi kill zone, but not that far out enough to be safe, considering we now have uranium in U.S. water supplies. Been confirmed. That's right. Go to the tap and drink some of it. And find out how good it tastes. Welcome back. My very special guest is Bob Nichols from Veterans Today. And one last part that we wanted to cover in this short segment was about a report coming out of India concerning a remarkable drop in fertility. What's happening there, Bob?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned that. The American Expeditionary Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, they used the monsoon Now, my colleague Loren, who you had on yesterday, is an expert on this. But they use the monsoons to blow this uranium dust to India. Been doing it for 20 years. And it just took hold. And the Indian government announced that the total fertility rate of the Indian people has plummeted from 2.9 children per woman to 2.6 in only 3 years. Now, the thing about it is the 3 years. It's a huge drop in a really short period of time. And, of course, I think that this is because of the uranium oxide, and so does Loren. And, of course, the Indian scholars and all those people are running around saying, well, what is it? What is it? What is it? Something we ate? Is it pesticides? Well,
yeah, it's pesticides uranium, from Monsunto.
When you mix uranium together with pesticides or sugar or whatever you're going to eat, the effects are synergistic. But the uranium remains about 10 million to 100 million times more awful. Genotoxic is what it's called. Worse. 100 million times worse than the most vile chemical. And that's what's attacking the Indian people right now. They don't know it. Their government is trying to push some new reactors they want to buy from the Americans. So they're not telling them. It's a tragedy, repeating itself again and again and again. And now it goes from Israel, where the government reported, the sperm bank in Israel reported that the sperm count is down 40% for the nation, to Iraq, where we know what's happening there, and now India, where the fertility rate has dropped precipitously. So how many thousands of hectares or acres do you want, millions you want to cover? How many, so what is that, a billion people, 2 billion people? We're talking about between Israel and India, including India. It is the contrast between that exquisite aria that you were just playing during the break and the reality of this stuff is just mind-boggling.
And the ongoing effects will be felt by future generations, if there are any.
if there are any. And that's the bottom line, is that what this stuff is designed to do by the American Expeditionary Forces is to eliminate people. It's called genocide.
But they're doing it to the whole planet at the same time, aren't they, Bob? I mean, what do you think about the high levels of...
It's not like the uranium oxide goes up to the border and says, oops, there's the border drawn in the sand there. We better stop. No, it just goes right on.
Yeah, it's like all the oceans being connected. Some people can't understand that. But, I mean, what do you think
of... you? Have little gates there. They don't go between... They don't go back and forth, do they?
They stop on the Queen's declaration of the boundaries, yeah.
Oh, of course, Yes, yes, the Queen.
What do you think?
Doesn't the Queen own all of your land? 6 inches?
No. Actually, she sold us out to the Lisbon Treaty. I forget who owns us now.
The IMF owns us now.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Yeah. They're really good guys there. I like them. I like their religion the most. But Bob, what do you think of the uranium and U.S. water supplies and strontium and plutonium and everything else?
Oh, well, this started years ago, but it just recently doubled. And we're talking, the Los Angeles water supply has been keeping records for decades. And the uranium in the water just recently dumped. And, of course, this is, I mean, 17 million, there are 17 million people within the five counties of Los Angeles. That's bigger than some countries. That's why California, one of the reasons why California is the eighth largest economy in the world. And to have the uranium in the water supply is just, it's incomprehensible.
It, what does old Barack have to say about it?
These things can't be happening. But the uranium, it blows across the ocean.
And it's making its way to a town near you. Thank you very much, Bob Nichols, for coming on the show today.
Enjoyed it. Hey, well, you know, it's terrible, but you got to do this.
Hey, you know, if you stop wanting to discuss the issues that you are afraid of, it doesn't stop it from happening. And if you do discuss it, then people are aware, and then they can defend themseles. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Well, AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And we'll be back with hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio at the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. Dust particles funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation to bed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses. Number two, man, it just breezes straight on by every single day. And quite frankly, we've got nothing but bad news to tell you, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, isn't it the role of news organizations, Will, that they just basically keep telling you and telling you and telling you and telling you worse and worse and worse stuff just to keep you like trapped in that little fear paradigm, like, oh, I don't want to go out of my front door. Everything's too scary. The police will get me.
That's a difference between us and the mainstream media, I think, is because most news is bad news because, well, hey, there's enough airy-fairy fluffy stuff going on. We don't need to contribute to that. people are feeling good about looking in the mirror and putting on makeup and crap, but the news is trying to make you fearful to propel government and corporate agenda, whereas we're trying to make you not fearful but conscious of government and corporate agenda. So that's the difference.
Yeah, and speaking of contrast, mate, I mean, I don't watch Campbell Live, and for those of you who don't know who John Campbell is, go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, and the video on the left is Celebrities and Politicians for 9/11 Truth. The man will ambush this guy, and he's basically like the Walter Cronkite of New Zealand. And
he's not even that, man. He's just a piece of maggot trash, basically. He's yeah.
Couldn't agree more. I've been a journalist for 20 years, he tells us. And guess what fabulous journalistic prowess he is displaying now? He is trying to find a Cheryl West lookalike, which is a famous television show here in New Zealand, which has just recently been cancelled. Okay? And he's almost outdoing himself today as well. He's doing an expose on which beauty parlor is the best for you.
Because these are things we need to expose. I mean,
oh, straight up, man. Reality. I mean,
this stuff matters. Eh? Like, I'm trying to conjure my own reality. If I think these happy things about makeup and beauty parlors, I will just live a Mary Poppins life.
Yeah.
Just so ridiculous.
Yeah, my auntie today, I mean, I was telling people about how the uranium's in the water and that kind of stuff, and she tells the person that I was talking to, oh, don't listen to him, I'm his auntie and I don't. Oh, the arrogance.
It really is. They talk about arrogance and ignorance and all this sort of stuff, and, well, New Zealanders aren't either, and all they want to pretend they're all open-minded libertarians out in space or something, and they're just the most arrogant, ignorant trash you come across, you know.
Oh, don't you love being in New Zealand? You're listening to the Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and Rush FM in Hamilton. We'll be right back. Yeah, and no one like me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader. My very special guest today is Sue Bradford. She's she was a Green MP and an activist beforehand, and I'd like to bring her on today to talk about benefit cutting, because this is happening more recently in New Zealand as it happens in the United States and many other countries around the world. It seems to be happening simultaneously, and I wanted to learn a bit more about the New Zealand perspective because, quite frankly, admittedly, I don't understand the issue at present. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Great to talk to you today.
Well, you know, it's fabulous to have somebody of such social stigma on the show. Now, the benefits are being cut. How big are the cuts? Where's it coming from? Who's responsible?
It's not quite as clear as that. What's happened earlier this year, the government brought in some new legislation around benefits, which is doing things like work testing sole parents once the youngest child turns six, which means that they're basically harassing solo mums back out to work, very much on the American model. And the second thing is that they're doing a lot more to work test and harass people who are on the sickness benefit and starting to try and push people over from what we call here the invalid benefit onto the sickness benefit. And the sickness benefit is paid at a much lower rate than the invalid's benefit, which means if people are pushed like that, they're getting less money, and benefits in this country are already very low. But what we're people like myself who are activists in the welfare and poverty area, what we're even more worried about is what John Key, our Prime Minister, and Paula Bennett might do next year. We've had something called the Welfare Working Group established by the government, and they're going to make a whole lot of recommendations in February next year. And so far from what we've seen, we're very concerned about the directions that the government might be taking. And that's why I've been part of this thing called the Alternative Welfare Working Group, which received a whole lot of submissions and went around the country talking to people and has just launched a major report last week, trying to put up other ideas about how our welfare system could be reformed that don't involve harming people.
And what kind of alternatives are you suggesting? I mean, specifically, the government, they want to take people off of the benefit after they've been on it for, say, a year, or rather review them after a year, whereas previously that wouldn't have to happen. How would that affect people that are currently on the benefit?
Well, yes, that's one of the other reforms that's already happened, is if that you're registered on the unemployment benefit, you automatically are taken off after 1 year and have to reapply. And some people get very frightened and freaked out when that happens. and just fall off the benefit and end up with no income. So that's the biggest danger, especially at a time when unemployment is quite high and I think will be rising in the year ahead. But some of the worst things that we fear the government will do next year include doing a lot more to push most beneficiaries, sole parents, sickness, invalids, everybody, into what is called the work-tested category. So in other words, they'll be trying to apply the sort of work-testing regime that's currently imposed on unemployed beneficiaries onto most beneficiaries, leaving just a few people who are in a very bad situation on the invalid's benefit at a higher rate. And that's really the worst of what we see is happening. They have put up a whole lot of options, the government working group, including things like, for example, work testing sole parents when their youngest child is 3 or when their youngest child is 1. Again, very much like the Wisconsin model that some people listening to this are probably very familiar with. They've even talked about if a woman's on the benefit and she has any further children while on the benefit, that they won't pay any more allowances for those children and that they'll work test her on the first child only. And one of our biggest worries is that this whole thrust is so anti-women and children that it will push more and more women and children into even deeper poverty than they're in already. And
which will most likely increase the rates of crime.
That's right. And recently, I was in Wellington last week, and this is just a rumour. Basically, I can't go direct to source on it because of confidentiality, but in a private meeting with church leaders, the Prime Minister, John Key, said to the church leaders, quote, "If we cancel welfare for 330,000 people currently on welfare, how many would starve to death? Bugger all." Now, I don't think that the Prime Minister is going to cut welfare to 330,000 people because he knows that the electorate won't stand for it. But what scares me about that quote is that it's indicative of Mr. Keat's thinking on welfare. That is, in this country, if you just leave people without any income, they're going to survive somehow. Which brings me back to what you just said, Vinny, that if we have that situation, we'll go very rapidly down the route for what's already happening in big parts of America, where we would have much increased homelessness, begging. We have begging in the streets already, but a lot more people begging in the streets. And, of course, our crime rate would go through the roof. And we already have one of the most imprisoned populations, nothing like the States, but pretty bad for a small country like ours. No thought that actually keeping people in prison is far more expensive than paying an unemployment or a sole parents benefit. And so I am very frightened that we may be heading down what pertains in much of the United States very quickly.
I'm concerned about, you understand the Hegelian dialectic of creating a problem and then as people react to the problem, propose the solution. My expectation is that the government will do this in an effort to heighten public need, so to speak, for a more stronger and brutal police regime. Because if you look at legislation such as the Search and Surveillance Bill, this new SIS bill, I believe that our country is becoming more and more a police state in a totalitarian tiptoeing fashion, so that people will not understand why there's men with black uniforms on the streets bashing up protesters. Because a whole bunch of different things caused by the government would have been responsible for such a problem in the first place. Now, considering that, where exactly is the government trying to justify doing these types of things?
The justification for the welfare reforms is that, that they're saying, what the government is saying is basically that we've got a crisis, that this country is in deficit and that we can't afford to keep paying welfare at the rates that we currently are. Now, benefit levels in this country are already very, very low, much lower than national superannuation. Wages are low as well, but benefits are even lower than wages. And what the government's welfare working group is doing is exactly what you're talking about. they're manufacturing a crisis that doesn't exist. They're trying to pretend that welfare costs are going to balloon out of hand over the next 40 years, and that because of the threat of those ballooning costs, they're going to have to make all these changes, which many of us are so scared of. It's a very classic capitalist tactic, as Naomi Klein has talked about, the manufactured crisis, and that's exactly what they're doing. When you look at the government's own Treasury budget, and Treasury is not a left-wing cabal, they're very right-wing themselves, but Treasury's own budget last year showed that the ballooning cost of this country will not be in working-age welfare payments, but in superannuation paid to our older people. It will be in health costs, a lot of that because of the ageing population, and also in the cost of servicing our financial debt. Those are the sort of costs that are going to go out of hand, nothing to do with working-age welfare. And in none of this does the government pay any attention to the fact that the main reason welfare numbers in this country are going up at the moment is because of unemployment. Simple fact, if you have more people out of work, you have more people on the dole. And they never talk about that.
Mm. Well, they wouldn't really, because they'd have to talk about something real then. And in my experience, the two main parties, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, don't approach real issues, because it means that they would have to approach real solutions. And if solutions are, in fact, implemented, it means that they would lose their justification to pass whatever legislation they like. That's my opinion, of course. But on top of this, what's going on with benefits in terms of costing? Because how much does a benefit, the benefit payments cost annually, as opposed to the government borrowing $250 million a week, indebting our country to international banks? And in fact, no, they've just upped that to $300 million a week.
That's right. Well, in terms of playing with figures, they say that it costs about $6 billion a year for welfare here. And when they did this manufactured crisis thing, they said that by 2050, welfare in this country would grow to $50 billion a year. But these figures are totally out of hand, because they made that calculation on an insurance risk basis, which says that we will count the cost of every beneficiary, every person that's got a benefit now, staying on a benefit for the rest of their lives. Now, most people on benefits actually go off them reasonably quickly, especially when jobs come back. Most people on benefits desperately do not want to be on them, and they're using these totally artificial figures to claim that there's a crisis. In terms of how you spend money, that is up to a government. This government has chosen, at the same time as it's saying we've got to cut welfare costs because we can't afford it. For example, in the last budget in May this year, they gave tax cuts to the very rich at a much higher rate than any tax cuts to the poor. And those tax cuts to the rich were paid for, and the Prime Minister made no bones about it, paid for out of borrowing. So they're prioritising tax cuts for the rich over the needs of low-income families and their children. They've also spent over $1.5 billion of government money towards the bailout of South Canterbury Finance. And they paid $100 million to keep The Hobbit, you know, to an American film company, to keep The Hobbit production here, and so on and so on. So it's all a matter of where your priorities lie. And this government is choosing to bail out investors and finance companies rather than support low-income people and their families. And these are the sort of choices that are being made daily in America and Europe and around the world. But that doesn't mean that some of us accept those choices. Some of us are fighting back.
Well, anybody who would actually look at the reality, you know, this is funny, Sue, because every time that I listen to John Key, this one phrase comes up that he uses repeatedly. Well, the reality is, and I'm just going to borrow a little leaf out of his book. The reality is that if we followed America and followed the EU, we would have crises like they've got in America and like they've got in the EU. I mean, it's pretty stark obvious. Now, you'd figure that an international bankster like John Key, who was on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank for 2 years as the head of derivatives under Merrill Lynch, derivatives being one of the prime causes of the 2008 global credit crisis, you'd figure he'd understand, being a man who's worth $50 million, that borrowing and borrowing and borrowing doesn't get you out of debt, and indeed just puts you into the territory of receivership. What does he think, that New Zealand's going to get bailed out by the international banks once we collapse? I don't think so.
No, we're living in a little bubble here in New Zealand, protected mainly by the umbrella of Australia, whose economy's been doing very well because of its, basically, I think, because of its natural resources. But that little bubble's going to burst sometime. And at the same time as we've got that, as you say, we've got a Prime Minister who's basically a gambler, you know, someone who made his fortune of $50 million gambling on derivatives and other financial instruments. And I think he brings that gambling perspective to our money and our lives. I don't know what his values base is, and that scares me. In the 90s, we had a right-wing national government as well, but it was led by Jim Bolger, who was a Catholic. And I can really see a difference between Jim Bolger, who actually did have some values, and who I think in later years, under the influence of church leadership, actually decided that perhaps the really right-wing direction they were taking was going too far and sacked Ruth Richardson as finance minister, for example. Now, Jim Bolger, who I demonstrated against many times, at least he had that value space. What really scares me with John Key is I don't think he has that. He doesn't have the empathy. He's a very jovial, friendly, cheery chap, and people love him because of his smile. But what concerns me is what lies behind that smile.
It's the key deception. I would think that, and I've interviewed John Key once, and I've not bothered to try again, simply because of the fact that he is, as far as I'm concerned, an incredible actor. And coming from an acting background, and my cousin being Lucy Lawless, I know what good acting is, and that's precisely what he does. He is smiling. He manages to dodge questions with a skill that I've not seen before. And like, for example, in Parliament, when Keith Lock questioned him over why the new SIS bill was being conducted in secret, instead of answering the question, he said, oh, Helen Clark conducted stuff in secret previously, right? So he kind of passes the buck. Now, in terms of leadership, in my opinion, a good leader is not the person who passes the buck. A good leader is the person for whom the buck stops with. He's not doing that. But the brain dead, sorry, New Zealand audience, the brain dead Kiwi public who vote for this person and love this two-party false left-right puppet show are still convinced by this, which is true testament to his acting prowess.
Mm, you're right. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. He's very good. He's very good at acting, and he's very, very personable, however you say it. Yeah, I mean, people do warm to him. It's a great attribute in a politician, but very scary with this particular politician because he is clever and he is a gambler. And he knows whose side he's on. There's still this idea that he's really not so bad, that he's, you know, people like Don Brash are used as stalking horses to say, well, John Key's nowhere near as bad as Don Brash. But in fact, I don't believe his politics are any different. It's just he keeps them better hidden.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Their politics don't change. It's just their tactics of delivering those politics changes, right? So what kind, if we were to do a credible analysis of how the National Party is running this government, my analysis would basically stem from production of crises. Now, if that is the case, what's the end game here? What are they planning to do to this country? Because we see things, the talk of privatization. We see the increase of taxes. We see the erosion of civil liberties. We see the cutting of social services. My very special guest today, yeah, the older government seems to be going a tad rogue lately. And I'm just kind of really concerned about all this business, you know, if that's what you can call it, because that's what governments are being run like these days. They're not being run like a supposed to be a government, which is to protect people's rights, are they? Well, it's been run like a business.
Well, yeah, it's not even a business. I mean, too many people say it's about money. Hey, it's a lot more than that.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And we'll be right back after the break at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Divided we fall. Unity, please don't desert me. Are we headed for despotism? Because that's exactly what the if the key fits, so to speak.
I mean, that's the big worry. I'm just aware that I'm a little older than you, and I've been through generations of people making the same sort of predictions and having the same fears about a move to totalitarianism. But I think you are still, despite having seen waves of that, and it doesn't happen, thank goodness. But we do need to be aware of the possibility. And one of my biggest fears in terms of us not having a strong Labor Party here. Is that people will move to the right in the absence of anything on the left to whom they can turn. Because we are living in very dangerous times for all the reasons you've just said. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I'm very concerned this government might sign up to, you know, is just one example of that, of allowing America and American corporations to have enormous control over our economic lives. And that in itself would be dreadful. But as you say, the threat with all the search and surveillance and SIS legislation that they're looking at for next year is the threat to civil liberties alongside the move to privatisation is very scary. And I guess what concerns me a lot at the moment is that Key continues his mantra that we're not going to do all these things in the first term, but if they get voted back in at our general election next year...
Oh, and they will.
On every poll, the indication is that they will. The real threat then is that they will start to do a much faster, worse reform agenda than what they're already talking about, and that becomes very frightening indeed.
In terms of resisting them, though, what can people do? I mean, you're an experienced activist. I mean, have you had any successes in resisting as an activist rather than as an MP?
Apart from 10 years as a Member of Parliament, I've spent most of my life as a street activist and community activist from the time I was really young. Looking back over it, I've been part of waves of activism that have in the end succeeded. For example, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the Springbok tour, the anti-nuclear, you know, trying to get nuclear warships out of our harbours. A lot of those things did work in the end. We, of course, withdrew from the Vietnam War, and people that supported it went on later to say, no, we shouldn't have been part of it. Those of us who protested against ties with apartheid South Africa later on, even right-wing government was saying that we did the right thing. Of course, our government voted to not allow US nuclear warships in our harbours. So in that sense, a lot of protest movements I've been part of have in the end succeeded. The ones that haven't in the end succeeded have been the economic ones, because from 1983 onwards, my main work has been in the unemployment, welfare and poverty area. And while we carried out many, many protests through the 80s and 90s, you can't exactly say we won anything. Things are only getting worse. But at the same time, it's absolutely critical that as many of us as possible do keep engaging in organised action to expose what's going on in the welfare, poverty and unemployment area, to fight for people's well-being and living, fight against what the government's doing, and also put up constructive alternatives, because I think it's really important always to do more than just protest. It's really important to put forward courageous and far-sighted alternatives what is happening, because if you just protest and get away, people will disrespect you. And what this is about is, for me, is trying to create a new and better society, which is a lot fairer and more humane. And I've spent my life trying to do that. And there are a lot of New Zealanders, just as there are many, many Americans, working for that same goal. And at the same time, of course, being aware of what's happening with the physical environment around us, and of the absolutely necessary links between things like resource depletion and the interconnection with that with what's happening for ordinary people in poverty.
Now, specifically back on the benefits, I mean, what the government is doing, what would you propose instead?
Our report, for those in New Zealand, or actually even overseas if you're interested, our report, our two reports from the Alternative Welfare Working Group are available online. At, if you just go to Welfare Justice in New Zealand, you'd be able to pick up full copies of those reports. In the main report that we issued last week, we actually have a whole chapter that looks at alternative solutions. But the big solution is that a whole lot of things are interconnected. Health, education and income are absolutely imperative in terms of the well-being of children and families, that you can't just look at welfare in isolation from work, from housing, from education and so on. You know, children only get a good start in life if they're in good health, if they have access to early childhood education and schooling, if their parents are earning enough money to live on. And you can't just separate welfare out from all of that. So that's the key, you know, the first thing. The second thing I'd say is that what sort of welfare system you have depends on what values base you have as a society. And we actually believe that New Zealand is a lot more humane and fair and compassionate than what our current government would make out, that people in this country don't want to keep going down the track towards the worst of what's going on in the US or the UK at the moment. We don't want a society that's more and more divided, where the gap between the rich and poor keeps growing. And if you start from that values base, then there's a whole lot of other things that can happen. For example, saying that actually getting unemployed people into work, real work at a decent wage, should be the priority of the economic and welfare system, not leaving people to languish on benefits that are too low to live on. This government has no commitment to job creation or support for work, apart from a very tiny program in building a cycleway, which is just pitiful. I mean, it's great they're doing it, but it's tiny in comparison to the number of jobs that need to be created. So getting people into work is a priority. Lifting welfare levels to amounts that people can live on. Our welfare payments are very, very low, if you can get them at all. And often what happens to beneficiaries is that they just end up further and further in debt, both for the government itself and private lenders, in a bid to survive. The problems of substandard housing and homelessness are going up all the time here, and that is in part due to the fact that our welfare pays so little, and that the government squashed the whole state housing building program. And then there's a whole lot of reforms that are needed around social welfare legislation itself, and I don't know what extent your listeners would be interested in that.
Well, I've written a little couple of notes here about what National's done so far in terms of cutting funding, and so far they have cut funding to the adult night classes, including hobby classes like belly dancing and painting, numeracy and literacy. They've cut funding to the Enviro Schools Foundation of 670 schools, Education for Sustainability Advisory Services, the Mātauranga Taiao, or Education for Sustainability Support for Kura Kaupapa Māori, the Householder Sustainability Program, the Public Place Recycling Program, the Government 3 Program, which is coordinated by the Ministry of the Environment to deliver leadership and sustainability practices by government agencies, the Sustainability Business Network. They've put ACC levy hikes up. They've cut funding to road education funding, to Ngā Kā Whai Kāwhanama Marama I Ngāturi, the Māori National Law Centre. They've also cut funding to walking and cycling funding, tertiary education funding, and also $700 million from the Fast Forward Fund for Agricultural Research. They've forced the Super City legislation. They're putting in the Search and Surveillance Bill. They're trying to open up the national parks for mining. They're increasing taxes on tobacco, outlawing cell phone use while driving, which is basically going to be like another unapportioned tax that the police can really get off people, and also they've cut funding to DOC, and now they're dropping 1080 in Fiordland. You know, it's a laundry list, and I haven't got all the, I don't have all of the legislation that they've passed here, right? I've got like maybe a fifth of it.
Yes, you could go on. I mean, privatising our prison services is one of them. Privatising prisons on the American model is one of the worst things they're doing. Prioritising building more motorways over public transport and the need to move our transport system to a much more environmentally sustainable and affordable one. There's so many things. I mean, that's a good list, but it's actually a lot longer. And
Yeah. And like the list is entitled "What National's Done So Far," you know, and it's not been updated, you know.
just in the area I work in, but coming back to the first part of your list, one of the worst things that I've seen, with the Alternative Welfare Working Group, we actually had a lot of meetings with beneficiaries and community groups around New Zealand over the last couple of months, and one of the things that really affected me the most was hearing from people that just feel totally locked out of education because of the education cuts, not only to adult education and night school, but also to access to tertiary education now. So people on a benefit, on say a solo mum with children, who's very keen to go to university to get an education so that she can get off the benefit and get a decent job doing something she wants to do, like being a nurse or a teacher, for example. But she can't now get access to tertiary education, so nor can she get access to a decent job. So people are being locked out of both education and work. And a lot of people are really feeling that, and it really hits them hard because they've got the government berating them for being on a benefit and saying they're not doing enough to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But when they come to actually try and get an education, they're locked out. And the same at another level, like one of the things we heard were from people who are migrants to this country, like most other countries, we have a lot of migrants now, people who come here to make a better life for themselves. Some of them come here with money and highly professional people, and they can do okay. But there's a lot of other people who aren't doing so well. And the cuts to night school classes and continuing adult education have really impacted them. At the same time as they too are being told to get out and get a job. But if they don't have good language skills, if there's other skills about adapting to our country that are really tough for them, they're not getting access to the same kind of help they used to. So it's like the government's locking people out and knocking them down at the same time as abusing them. And it's pretty nasty stuff.
They don't want people to be capable of critical thinking because that would threaten what they're doing, you know. And I'd like to thank you very much, Sue, for coming on the show today. Do you have a website or anything that the listeners might be able to catch up with your work on?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter at this point. So anyone can feel free to follow me on Twitter or Facebook. And if you really want to get in touch with me, message me on Facebook and I'll give you my email address. I'm also part of a group called Auckland Action Against Poverty, which we've just set up. Anyone listening to this that would like to get involved, again, contact me. We hope to have a web page up and running shortly, but we haven't quite got there yet.
All right. Thank you very much, Sue, for coming on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Thank you for having me.
Are we headed for despotism? Now, I apologise, ladies and gentlemen, for the quality of that particular recording. We have a fabulous monopolistic country who has decided that it's a great idea for one enormous telecommunications company to have basic power over the airwaves and whatnot. And Sue was joining us via a telecom stick, which apparently doesn't provide that much connection. So you will have to forgive me. But I thought that the interview was quite amicable. And I know that Will has quite a bit to say about this being the rampant right winger that he is.
I don't have much to say. You know, she's probably trying to save power of the telecom stick, you know, to aid climate change. But no, I'm sorry, Sue. Now, look, I agree. I'm glad there's some resistance and some spirit of resistance in a lot of people. I'm glad that a lot of the commies that get out on the street aren't completely fluoridated to apathy. But I'm not glad that they can't analyze what they're supposedly against. You're against money, you're against the United States? Okay, here we go. Why don't we break it down physically for you? Why don't you look at a US $1 bill that FDR, a 32nd degree Freemason, had designed back in, 34, I believe, with on the left-hand side, a great pyramid with the Roman numerals, 1776, incidentally, not just the Declaration of Independence was signed in that year, but almost simultaneously on the 1st of May, the Bavarian Illuminati was founded. And there you go. There's the Illuminati's uncapped pyramid symbol on the left-hand side, designating the left-hand path of occult magic. See, these people don't know anything like that. Just think the dollar bill's random. Hey, you can think life's random. You can think everything come together by chance and time, but you can't possibly tell me that the designs on the US dollar bill are completely random, happened via an explosion in the printing press. The Great Seal of the United States with the eagle holding an olive branch with 13 leaves and 13 berries, and in its other talon holding 13 arrows, and it's got 13 tail feathers, and it has 13 stars or pentagrams above it, making up a Star of David. I mean, why don't you look into the design of things and find out who runs the system?
Indeed he do. Speaking of running the system, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and Rush FM in Hamilton. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Now, Will, we were talking over the break about how you don't agree with welfare because the ultimate, the ultimate tug in there is that if you get people on welfare, it just gives the central bankers an extra hook in the economy. They just loan more money to the government, and then it's more in debt, and,
it's a hard one, because if I say I'm against welfare, people are like, well, what do you mean, but I'm dependent on that and everything else, and it's like, yeah, I know what it's like to be poor too. You bet. But the problem is, Band-Aid solutions aren't the solution. You just dig yourself into more trouble, and the bankers laugh at us. We need a fundamental revolution. But not the final revolution that the occult empire want. Here's the problem. Too many people are at ground level trying to work out the ultimate problems from the ground. Trying to think of an analogy here, but you can't say there's a giant weed and it's coming up alongside a nice tree, and this giant weed is 6 foot up and you can see some of the nasty thorns coming off it, and you're just trying to pick thorns off. I'm saying you've got to go to the bottom, you've got to go to the roots, and you've got to pull that weed out by the roots. People are saying, well, it doesn't have any roots. I just see spikes and leaves and all these flowers coming off it, and I don't like that flower, but I like this one. No, I don't like the National Party, but I like the Labour one. And they're saying there's this giant tree, there's this giant society, there's this establishment, but it doesn't have any roots. And I'm saying, look, there's roots. It's the OTO, it's the Golden Dawn, it's the Bavarian Illuminati, it's the Masons, it's the Catholics, it's all of them. at the pinnacle, not the average Mason or the average Catholic. And they just say, no, conspiracy theory, tree doesn't have roots. The problem is a lot of the left are trying to work out what ultimately runs a system from the tiny little things that they observe affecting them. John Key wants to take my benefit. He's right wing. Left wing must be good. That isn't logic. The more that they, just like having protracted wars in the Middle East, the more that they can get governments to spend on health, on education, making us all sick, making us all stupid, the more that they can indoctrinate a society to be dependent on government, the more the central banks get to loan out to our respective governments, the more they indebt us all. That's why we're in over $800 billion worth of debt officially. It's actually a lot more than that. This is a fundamental problem. The answer is dependence from government, reducing government. And yeah, that's a right-wing thing, but hey, if we get away from those terms and the propagandist connotations that have been implanted in our minds, we start to see, that's how our ancestors lived, independent. Sure, there are wars. There's always going to be wars and fights. People disagree. People disagree with me right now, most people probably. But it's about getting your own food, your own water supply. Stop being lazy. being, you know, most people think being lazy is not going out to work for the corporations. No, that's stupid. That's tyranny. That's economic slavery.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's almost the end of independence. This is the era that we're going into now, is that everybody's going to be dependent in one form or another. People have got either one source of income, whether that be from the government or from their prospective employers, and all you got to do is just take that away from them, and they're completely effed. You know, there's nothing they can do. They're absolutely, so totally 100% screwed.
Too many people are pragmatic, i.e. they try and work out society and the flaws in society from the practical consequences. So, no job, bad. Government want to take job, bad. But instead of thinking of the fundamental consequences, that's why people have a go at fundamentalists of any nature in society. But there are fundamentals. If you don't have fundamentals underpinning your worldview, then what do you have? Relativism. And if you have relativism, then the people running society can always change the parameters, can always set the agenda, and they can turn things 180 degrees on you, over a few generations, but that's exactly what they've done.
All the kids have been indoctrinated, and I've always said that our generation's problem is, the biggest problem is that we read between the lines so much we miss the lines themselves, and we don't react when these lines are crossed anymore. When somebody comes out and says that, bailing out huge amounts of banks and getting into enormous amounts of debt is right wing, I just got to laugh, because that is not what right wing is about at all. In fact, is there even a distinct left or right anymore? Or have they're exactly the same now, aren't they? You have
John Key, even if John Key understands libertarianism or conservatism, he sure as hell doesn't practice it, because he can't, because he is a pawn for the international bankers. And then people want to say, who are they? Look, I'll leave that to you. But he is a pawn. Helen Clark is a pawn, still, in the UN, most definitely. These people are pawns, sadly. They don't actually represent the power. They don't have any real power. They have some symbols, some icons, some anecdotal hand-me-downs from power, but they don't have any real power.
They're like police officers. They're like police officers wearing a uniform, and that uniform gives them the power. You take away that uniform, the facade disappears, and you realize that they are just a scared, pathetic little rat.
But people think we're making this up. Mayor Rothschild said all this. He said, I care not who's in control of a population. Let me issue their currency, and I care not of their political persuasion. They don't care, but they love socialism. They like, because it gives them the power to make everything equal and fair, and that's a sales pitch, and they get you all addicted to government, and so they can grow their big empire. They can grow their police state. They can grow their militaries. See, how else could they do it?
And what I find ironic is that if you have a look at any big socialist takeover, any big right-wing takeover, they all end up in tyranny. So what the heck is the fundamental difference? There isn't one. Because if you are in power, you're there because they want you to be there. Because they want you to convince the public of something that isn't true, so that they can take control of you, your country, and your children forever. That's the game here. Total, full-spectrum dominance.
And it has to be said, Vinny, the end game is something very simple. The end game of what we want is freedom, something called freedom. Freedom means smashing through a lot of these baloney laws and intellectually rebelling.
Indeed. We'll be back tomorrow, folks.